Okay, good morning, everybody. Hello, hello, hello. All right, let's get going because we got a big, long chapter. The nervous system is a big, long chapter, so I don't want to waste too much time getting into it. So let's see. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, March 10th. And here go the lights. There we go. Okay, one more. Fantastic. Let's look at the schedule. Okay, so indeed it is the 10th. And we got three lectures on nervous system, maybe a little bit more. I hope not too much more because we still have to cover autonomic nervous system before the test. So we got two more chapters to cover before the test. So that makes you wonder, well, when is the test? So if today's the 10th, it's not on the 17th. That's 1 week, but it is on the 24th, so test is exactly 2 weeks from today, right, to give you a shot of what's going on. And then after that test, then guess what? You're halfway done with the class already. So that's good news, though some of you might be kind of sorry to hear that because you're learning a lot of cool stuff in here. All right, so, okay, you guys, come to order so that you don't disturb anybody that's around you, please. Please, please, please. Okay, if you got to talk to somebody, please step outside. Okay, step outside if you got to carry on a nice conversation. All right, so we are in Chapter 7, Nervous System. The beginning of this chapter pretty much is a review from what you know in anatomy already, but I'm still going to go over it. Any question on the schedule?
We didn't finish Chapter 5, did we?
As far as I remember. What else? I'll look it over. Maybe next time I'll make a comment or two about them.
Okay.
But I don't think I have any protein slides for you to look at.
Okay.
All right. So where we're stopping pretty much is beta oxidation, and then we talked about some other things regarding diet or diets, the two carbon fragments that you get, the acetyl group, which are chopped off of a fatty acid, or if you get a two-carbon fragment from ethyl alcohol, you can either get it into Krebs cycle to make energy or make a fat out of it. Those are the only two possible fates. Right? So when you drink alcohol, it's like eating butter, basically, because that's all your body can do with it. Okay. All right, so let's go to Chapter 7. All right, remember, the nervous system can be broken down into two main regions, two anatomical regions. So this is not physiologic regions. These are anatomic regions. And you know these to be? Yeah, you know these to be brain and spinal cord, which we call central nervous system. Everything else is called peripheral nervous system. So on the slide it says cranial and spinal nerves. Yeah, I suppose that's true, but it's all the nerves, not just cranial nerves, not just spinal nerves, but what they move into. All right, so those are two main divisions. We're going to look at each one of those divisions. And just like we can take the nervous system, break it down into two main regions, there are two kinds of functional cells that make up nervous tissue. Don't know what happened there, right? And these two functional groups of cells are called either neurons or support cells. Another name for a supporting cell is a glial cell. Sometimes you might want to say a neuroglial cell. You don't pronounce it like that in real life. It would be a neuroglia. Right? So maybe the first time you hear it, it doesn't make sense, but a neuroglia cell as opposed to neurons. And neurons are the functional part of the nervous system. In a sense, people have been interested in neurons for a long time because they can transmit information long distances in the body, but also in a rapid fashion. So if the central nervous system wants to control something down in your big toe, it can send a signal there, right, in mere milliseconds to control a muscle, for instance. All right, so that's the function of a neuron. The support cells, or glial cells, maintain the function of the neurons and actually might direct where these neurons are going to grow and if they can grow. So now people are very interested in the support cells because we know really what their function is, and it is just as extensive and just as important as what a neuron is. And actually you have five times more glial cells than you do neurons. But a neuron, the job of a neuron is to send electrical signals long distances and rapidly throughout your body. The glial cells have all different kinds of functions, and we're going to talk about them when we get into the next part of the chapter, after we talk about neurons. All right, so neurons are kind of interesting because they gather information, and sometimes they can decide what to do with that information and then transmit it to other cells. All right, so what is that part in a response loop that can make a decision, gathers information and makes a decision? Integration center. That's right. So neurons act as an integration center. You don't have to have a whole big network, but every neuron is an integration center. It gets information from a lot of different places, right? And then that information can be changed into electrochemical impulse, and that impulse then travels very fast to some distant location. And when that impulse gets to the end of that neuron, the end of that neuron changes that information into a different form, into a chemical message, right? And then that chemical message is then spread to another neuron someplace or an effector organ somewhere else, right? But it can only, these chemical messengers only can go a short distance, like through the synaptic cleft. Okay, so that's a job of neuron. Here we got a couple different shapes of neurons. Let's start with the one on the top first. Right, so any neuron you should break down into three main components. The component that contains the nucleus is what we call the cell body or soma, neuron cell body, and it contains rough endoplasmic reticulum, smooth endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi body, so it can make proteins, it can make complicated molecules. Right, so this is the main synthesis area of the cell, plus it contains the nucleus, which then, of course, determines the function of this cell as well. Okay. And on the other side, I see some projections that are highly branched. Sometimes we call these processes, right, like it's just an extension from the cell body. These in particular are dendrites. And this particular cell has many different kinds of dendrites, right, many different locations, and they branch off into other smaller dendrites. And then the last component of a neuron, we see one long projection or process, and this thing can be, I never calculated it out, it could be 1,000, could be 1,000,000 times longer, right, in length compared to a dendrite. Well, I got to do that calculation, right, because dendrites are just microscopic. This axon is microscopically thin, but it can go all the way from the spinal cord to the tip of your big toe. Right, so it's macroscopic in length. Right, and neurons have one of these things. This is called an axon. When you get down to the axon terminus, it can form branches as well. And you might notice that these branches are a little bit different looking because at the end of these branches, you see a little swelling. Dendrites never contain these little swellings. These are called, anybody know what these little swellings are called? Yeah, they're called synaptic knobs, synaptic terminals, synaptic buttons, Bouton terminali. Okay, it goes by a whole bunch of different names. Okay, and of course these things contain neurotransmitter vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. All right, when I look at this neuron, I also see something that shows a little bit of function of this neuron. Does anybody see any functional information on this slide?
Direction of conduction.
Ah, direction of conduction. Perfect. All right, so that's not anatomy. That is some physiology right there. So information will flow in this direction from dendrite to cell body to an axon down to the tip of an axon. Information does not flow from a tip of an axon back into the cell body and then to a dendrite over here. Information goes dendrite, cell body, axon. And as a matter of fact, sometimes that information can skip a dendrite and can go directly to a cell body, but information cannot go to an axon. Right? So, but I want you to think of dendrite, cell body, axon. That's how information flows, and not backwards in this axon. We're going to see why that is in just a little bit. Because there's different proteins in the membrane in these locations. The second row over here, I see another neuron. Oh, you know what? On both of these, I do see some neuroglia cells, which I'll point out in just a second. But anyway, the second one down here, B, that's another neuron. And it looks different. It still has a cell body. It has dendrites, and it has axons. The information flow is the same, dendrite, cell body, axon. Right? And you should know the names of these cells and what the function of these cells are. The top one is what we call a multipolar, right? Multipolar cell. These are really good neurons, or neurons that are used as interneurons in the central nervous system, but also motor neurons. A motor neuron can take information from the central nervous system to the periphery. So motor is important. What's another name for motor? I think I heard it. Yeah. An efferent neuron. Right? I probably don't want to say effector, because an effector would be, for instance, a muscle that's going to be attached to these axon termini right here. So an efferent. Now it's spelled efferent, but you don't really pronounce it efferent. You pronounce it efferent. Right? What's the other kind? What's the other kind besides efferent? Afferent. That's right. And that is a sensory neuron. Okay? So if I say afferent and efferent, it sounds the same, so I kind of make the efferent sound a little bit different, so even if there's an echo in the room, you can tell which one I'm talking about. All right, so this multipolar is efferent. The one on the bottom, right, is not an interneuron. Where do you find interneurons? I mentioned that. I just assumed that you knew what an interneuron is. Where do you find interneurons? In the central nervous system. Completely within the central nervous system. They don't have any piece outside the central nervous system. What's another name for interneuron? There's another name for it called an association neuron. Association or interneuron is the same. They're found only in the CNS. And CNS stands for central nervous system. Right. Okay, this one down here on the bottom has a little bit different shape. And this is what we call a pseudo-unipolar. Sometimes maybe you might want to call it a unipolar neuron, because there's one process coming out of the cell body and then bifurcates into a dendrite. Okay, these dendrites over here and the axon terminals over here. This long projection is what we're going to call the peripheral process. Right? And this one over here that leads to the axon terminus, this is what we're going to call the central process. Right? And the reason why we call it peripheral and central has to do with this very first slide. The nervous system can be broken down into central versus peripheral. And so that cell, that pseudo-unipolar neuron, part of it is in the peripheral nervous system, like I see right here. That's why we call this the peripheral process. This part of that pseudo-unipolar neuron goes into the central nervous system, so we call that the central process. So it's not by location necessarily, by being central or distal or whatever. It just depends on what part of the nervous system it is. Okay, but the direction of impulses is the same. Cell body is the nutritional center. It makes macromolecules, like I said. And if we put groups of these cell bodies together, as a matter of fact, that just happens normally. There are locations in our nervous system, in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system, where cell bodies group together. All those cell bodies will have basically the same kind of function. It's a functional area. We want to talk about that particular area, right? And in the central nervous system, groups of nerve cell bodies are called a nucleus. Yeah, so we use nucleus a lot in biology. So just by context, you would know that. If you would take a group of nerve cell bodies that we call a nucleus in the central nervous system, but move it out to the periphery, we have to change its name. Then it becomes a ganglion. Right? So a ganglion is singular. So a nucleus and a ganglion are very similar, just a group of nerve cell bodies, but in two different locations in the central nervous system. That's about it. Okay. There are some differences, and let me go back to that neuroglia cell that I promised you I would talk about. I see the neuron in this nice yellow color, but I also see some other kinds of cells. Here's a nucleus, right? So here, nucleus of a cell, right? I should probably mention that. So if people listen to the lecture, they make sure that this is not a group of nerve cell bodies. This is just a nucleus, an organelle inside of a cell. Right, and so here is a cell, and it has a different color, right? It looks more tan as opposed to yellow. So this is not a neuron. This is a support cell. And in the peripheral nervous system, we're going to call this a Schwann cell. OK? Okay? And the Schwann cell, we're going to spend a lot of time with, has some really nifty features. It acts like insulation around, right, this peripheral process or an axon, so that electrical information is retained within the neuron, doesn't leak out into surrounding fluids. Right, so here are, I see one class of neuroglial cells, and the chemical that it uses to make that insulation is called myelin. Myelin has a bit of a white color to it, right, even when you look at it underneath the microscope, or even if we look at a section through a brain. Right, so when we look at axons that are myelinated, right, they're going to have thousands of these axons traveling together. You're going to see a white area in the brain. But notice the dendrites and cell bodies. Are they going to look white? They don't have myelin, right? So they're not going to look white. They're going to look gray. Right, so so you have gray matter, white matter in the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. Gray matter, right, is going to be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. What do we call gray matter in the central nervous system? Oh, this is tough because we just talked about it. Gray matter in the central nervous system is a, we call it a, it's just in one little region, part of your brain. That is a, yeah, that's a nucleus. Okay, in the central nervous system. What do we call that gray area in the peripheral nervous system? Ganglion, right, okay, and here you see why. All right, I said that these axons travel together in groups, all right, and these are going to be white. And I didn't mention this, but maybe somebody knows from anatomy, what do we call white matter in the central nervous system, which are going to be groups of these axons? You could think of it as a cable carrying all kinds of wires someplace. What do we call white matter? We're going to call it a tract. That's right. So in the central nervous system, you have a nucleus, which contains nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and then you have the white matter, which is a tract. It's an axon going someplace, or a group of axons going someplace. In the peripheral nervous system, right, we say a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites is a ganglion, right? But a group of axons, which is white matter in most cases, that's just what we're going to call a nerve. So a nerve and tract match up together in two different locations. Ganglia and nucleus match up together, but in, what, two different locations in the central nervous system. Right. Another important thing, each of these neurons can transmit information only in one way. Only in one way. Okay, dendrites. Yeah, I think I mentioned everything on this slide already. Okay. So these electrical impulses travel in the, what we call, this is the forward direction from cell body down to this axon terminus. We might want to call that anterograde. Forward and anterograde are the same. What about the reverse direction? What are we going to call that? That is what we call retrograde. Yeah, retrograde. So retrograde would be going from the axon terminus into the cell body. Electrical impulses do not do that. But there are times when material should go, all right, in a retrograde fashion and other times in a anterograde fashion. So let's look at ways that this can happen. And we're still just talking about neurons. All right, so these long axons have to have a way of transporting materials like macromolecules in along an axon because they're really, really long. There are two main ways that this can happen. Axoplasmic flow is one, and one is axonal transport. Axoplasmic flow is pretty easy, and it's sort of like peristalsis within the digestive tract. So there are segments of the digestive tract that constrict, and that pushes material along in one direction through the digestive tract. Axoplasmic flow is similar because there are rhythmic contractions along the axon that moves material. Okay, so that's axoplasmic flow. Axonal transport is a little bit more specific, and it's not just a whole bulk of material that's in the axon, it's just specific molecules. And a specific molecule has to hop onto a little motor protein in order to hop a ride from one place to another. All right, so axonal transport moves large and insoluble compounds in either direction. And what kind of organelle is used to move things around inside of a cell or to determine the shape of a cell because it can push and pull on the plasma membrane? Those are microtubules, right? That's like the monorail system inside of a cell, and it exists in axons as well. And of course, that's there to give that axon shape, but also as a transport mechanism. Antegrade transport moves material away from the cell body down to the axon terminus. There's a special little motor protein molecule that we call a kinesin that moves material from the cell body down to the axon terminus. And if you look on YouTube, you can actually see some of these little molecules. I should probably put a link in your Blackboard. Actually, you can't take a picture of this molecule, but you can look at a simulation of what we know about these little motor proteins. Right. So antegrade, forward direction, retrograde transport from the axon terminus back into the cell body, right, uses a different kind of motor protein. It has a little bit different shape. That's called a dynein. Right, so a dynein moves material from the axon terminus back into the cell body. And as a matter of fact, there are some viruses that have learned to hop a ride on these dynein molecules. You might have a peripheral infection, and that virus can hop a ride on a dynein protein and travel really close to the central nervous system on that sensory nerve fiber. But if it's a motor fiber, it can go all the way into the central nervous system just by hopping a ride right here. All right, so here is a really nice anatomy slide. It's a synopsis of a lot of things that we've covered already. On this illustration, I see two main areas. Right, I see a blue area, which is the central nervous system, and then I see, an orange area. What do we got? What's on the left? Blue. What's on the right?
Green.
Green. Okay. All right, so you got blue and green signifying two different areas. Green is peripheral nervous system, and the blue is central nervous system. Indeed, I can see spinal cord. Is spinal cord really part of the central nervous system?
Yes,
it is. Okay. So this slide is really nice. And the only thing it's missing is an interneuron, because all three of these neurons that I see right here, I see part of it in the central nervous system, part in the peripheral, but if you're going to look at an interneuron, where would you find it? Completely within the central nervous system someplace. It's listed on the slide, but too bad it's not drawn in. Okay, so let's look at the top cell. Can you recognize the shape of this top cell? Yeah, it is a pseudo-unipolar. Okay, and we said that a pseudo-unipolar is a afferent neuron, always brings information from peripheral nervous system into the central nervous system. And then the one on the second row, that is a multipolar neuron, and we said multipolar neurons are motor neurons, and we see it going from central to peripheral. That is the definition of a motor neuron, right? Receiving signals on these dendrites in the central nervous system, and then electrical impulses move into the peripheral nervous system. So that's a nice motor neuron as opposed to what we saw in the top row, which is an afferent. And then here we see a scheme, for instance, in autonomic outflow from the central nervous system. We see two neurons back to back, and part of the first neuron, we call this the preganglionic neuron, has a cell body in the central nervous system. And the postganglionic neuron cell body is in the peripheral nervous system. Now, why do we call this a postganglionic neuron? Kind of heard something, a ganglion, that should like ring a bell. What's a ganglion? Yeah, it's a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. And here, we're in the peripheral nervous system, right? And I see one cell body, but this would contain hundreds or thousands of these nerve cell bodies. Right, and so this is what we call the postganglionic cell, because here is the ganglia, and the signals go in this direction, further out into the periphery, and here is the preganglionic cell. This is typical of autonomic outflow pathways. This middle cell, which is a motor neuron, say going to a skeletal muscle, it's not part of the autonomic nervous system. It only takes one neuron to go from the CNS all the way to effector organ. And we call that a somatic motor neuron. Somatic motor versus autonomic. Somatic just means one way to think about that is voluntary, right? Going through skeletal muscle. Too bad they didn't put in an association neuron, but you should draw it in. And what is the shape of an association neuron? Okay. It is a multipolar, just like this motor neuron right here. So draw in a nice little multipolar cell. That would be an interneuron. So we've talked about two of the kinds of cells already, pseudo-unipolar. And what's the function of a pseudo-unipolar? It's sensory. It's always going to be afferent, sensory or afferent. All right. And then here is a multipolar. What's the function of a multipolar? It's a motor neuron or association, motor or efferent. Yeah, motor or efferent, exactly the same thing. Or interneuron. The third kind of cell, which we haven't talked about, is a bipolar cell. All right, so here is a bipolar cell where we have a long dendrite with a lot of bifurcations at the tip and then sort of a long axon. Right, and the axon and dendrite originate from opposite sides, opposite poles of the cell. So this is a bipolar neuron. There are not many of these in your body, but they're involved with special senses like vision and olfaction. We find these kind of cells. So that means it's sort of like a sensory cell, but does not bring information into the central nervous system. It's more for processing information before it gets to the central nervous system. Okay, I have retina, vision. Yeah, I think I mentioned vision. Okay, so that is just a really brief view of neurons. We're going to learn a whole lot more about neurons in just a little bit. But anybody have a question about that basic terminology? All right, because I'll be using that. All right, so let's look at some support cells. All right, and I mentioned this one already. Here I see a nice multipolar neuron. The function of that is motor. For instance, a nice efferent neuron. Here is the axon, and then wrapped around the axon are various Schwann cells. And they wrap myelin around and around and around the axon, and as it wraps around, right, it pushes all the cytoplasm to the outermost layer of the Schwann cell, and that's what we call the neurolemma. The nucleus is in the neurolemma. So the myelin sheath are these inner layers. The outer layer right here is what we call the neurolemma. These are kind of short cells, not nearly as long as an axon, so that's why you see a series of them. And there's always going to be a gap between Schwann cells, and we call that a node of Rondier. All right, and we're going to find Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system only. Now, cells in the central nervous system can be myelated, but with a different kind of cell, which we're going to look at. All right, so that's all I want to say. Oh, yeah, here's that neurolemma. That's all I want to say about that Schwann cell right at the moment. The other kind of cell, I don't have a slide for you, is what we call a satellite cell. For instance, in a ganglion someplace in the, where do we find ganglia once again? Peripheral nervous system, yeah. In ganglia, which means peripheral nervous system, these cell bodies are not just sitting in the extracellular fluid, but they're surrounded by other cells, which we call satellite cells. Right? And they probably provide nutrition and other information to maintain the health and function of the neuron. Right? So you got satellite cells. Oh, it says right here, satellite cells and Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system. I just don't have a picture of a satellite cell. All right, let's move into the central nervous system. We got four kinds of support cells. And all of these are neuroglia cells. We got oligodendrocytes, microglia, astrocytes, and ependymal cells. All right, so I see a nice multipolar neuron. Here is that long axon. And is this axon myelinated? Indeed it is. It is not a Schwann cell. It is an oligodendrocyte. An oligodendrocyte can myelinate more than one segment of an axon. One oligodendrocyte not only can myelinate multiple sections of an axon, but it can myelinate multiple sections of multiple neurons. All right, so that's one of the functions of an oligodendrocyte, and it provides some of the same function as a Schwann cell, and sometimes it is different. I guess I'll talk about it right now. So why are axons myelinated? They're myelinated because it's an advantage when transmitting an electrical impulse. If an axon is myelinated, it can transmit that information hundreds of times faster. Okay, non-myelinated axons are slow. All right, so I think that was a commercial not too long ago. What's better, fast or slow? Fast is better, right? Got a bus coming at you, fast neurons are the kind of neurons you want. All right, so that nerve impulse skips from node to node, right? So it just hops down an axon as opposed to being carried continuously from molecule to molecule to molecule, right? So it skips. We call that saltatory conduction. All right, so both a Schwann cell and oligodendrocyte allow the skipping of a nerve impulse from one node to the other that speeds up its rate. I got a couple other slides that talk about that saltatory conduction. This is just a little bit of an introduction. All right, so to think about maybe saltatory conduction versus continuous conduction is slow. Let's say you're up at the head of the stairs over there and you want to get to the bottom. What would be the fastest way of doing it? Like jumping to every fourth stair, say you're strong enough to do that, or step on every stair. What's faster, every fourth or every stair? Yeah, jumping, hopping down the stairs is a lot faster. Same thing for that nerve impulse. All right. A Schwann cell will promote regeneration of an axon if it is damaged. That's part of its job. So you can have regrowth of motor function. You can have regeneration of sensory function if a peripheral neuron is damaged because of Schwann cells. But if you have damage to an axon in the central nervous system, oligodendrocytes secrete compounds that deliberately inhibit regeneration of an axon. And that is why spinal cord injuries are so damaging and you can't recover from them because what can you tell me about spinal cord? Is it CNS or PNS? And what kind of myelinating cells does it have? Oligodendrocytes, which prevent regeneration, right, of the spinal cord. Right? So you might want to ponder why that is. Why did we evolve to have that? It sure seems a whole lot better if we could just rebuild something after it's broken.
Would you say it does not now?
Oligodendrocytes inhibit regeneration of axons. And oligodendrocytes are in the central nervous system, so damage to axons in the central nervous system, right, they just remain damaged. They cannot regenerate, like spinal cord injuries. Right? And that's due to these oligodendrocytes. Even though they speed up the motion of a nerve impulse, or the speed of a nerve impulse, they inhibit regeneration. All right, so that's one type of cell. All right, so here are multiple axons off from this one oligodendrocytes. All right, let's look at some. Oh, here's back in the peripheral nervous system. These guys promote regeneration. I was pointing at a Schwann cell. Oh, and here it says, yeah, oligodendrocytes produce proteins that inhibit regrowth. Right, and they form a little blockage, which we call a scar, for that axon so it can't regenerate, can't grow back. Oh, this is not in your anatomy book. Great. So here I see some Schwann cells. Okay, and what part of the nervous system are we looking at? Yeah, peripheral nervous system, because that's where Schwann cells are. If there is damage to an axon, right, maybe some kind of laceration or a cut, of course, then this distal part or this part distal to the injury, right, it dies, right, it degenerates, and then is resorbed by the body. And then in the meantime, these leftover Schwann cells, okay, group together, and they form a tunnel, right, and that's called a regeneration tube. And that regeneration tube is number one, a pathway back to the effector organ, but that regeneration tube also secretes compounds, growth factors, so that the axon grows through the tube back to the effector organ. So that's one really nice thing about Schwann cells. Right, remember, oligodendrocytes will produce a scar right over the end of that injury. Maybe you could even think of it like a callus or something, right? But a scar so that that axon cannot regenerate and grow back to its particular effector organ. So usually we think that a neuron, they don't regenerate, right? So the kinds of neurons or the actual neurons that you have had in your body when you're 10 years old are the exact same neurons that you have right now, okay? So they don't undergo mitosis. They just stay there for your whole lifetime. But that might not actually be true. We're discovering a class of compounds called neurotrophins, right, and they promote fetal nerve growth, which is a good thing, right? But we also know now in the adult, some nerves or some neurons secrete neurotrophins. So some parts of our brain can regenerate, And as a matter of fact, that's one way that we can think of long-term memory, that when we learn something, right, neurotrophins are secreted, and that might cause an increase in the number of neurons in certain parts of our brain. But if not that, at least the amount of dendrites and branches that an axon terminus has, right? But in any case, the network of neurons becomes much more extensive as a result of neurotrophins. And it is also neurotrophin, again, is something that's secreted by that regeneration tube to cause a regrowth of a damaged axon. All right, so this is sort of interesting because we just said that in long-term memory, the structure of your brain changes, right? And we call that plasticity, neuroplasticity. And of course, when you take a physiology class, the shape of your brain is not anything at the end like what it was at the beginning of the class compared to the end of the class. It's got to change shape, okay? And I'm just amazed that all of you students hand your brains over to instructors to have them remodeled like that. But it's definitely something that happens. Okay? Your brain is changing shape just as we speak. Okay, it is really scary. So be careful who you listen to. All right, here is a second kind of neuroglia cell. It almost looks like an oligodendrocyte, but I don't see any myelin. This is an astrocyte. And astrocytes are well known to release neurotrophins. Right? So that's one of their important jobs. And this particular astrocyte, I can see that it has a process going over to a capillary, right? And then it has another process going over to a neuron. And so an astrocyte can act as a door-to-door delivery system for important metabolites, right? So it can absorb something from a capillary. Oh, what's special about a capillary?
Exchange.
Yeah, that's the only place where exchange takes place. So some material can leave the cardiovascular system in this capillary, right, hop a ride through this astrocyte and be delivered directly to this axon. All right, so it's like a really nice bridge. Astrodendrocytes also balance out the electrolytes in the interstitial fluid around neurons, and especially potassium levels. All right, so what should potassium be outside of a cell, high or low, compared to the inside? Yeah, it should be low, right? So astrocytes help do that. And because astrocytes can secrete neurotrophins, they help regulate neurogenesis, or the rebuilding of neurons in even an adult's central nervous system. And here I see an axon and an axon terminus. Then I see a space, and then I see a second neuron, all right? And here I see that axon terminus, or Bouton terminale, filled with vesicles, or this terminus is filled with vesicles, and inside the vesicle they're filled with neurotransmitter, right? And so when the top neuron wants to send information to the bottom one, okay, then it has to send it as a chemical signal. And that chemical signal is the neurotransmitter contained in these vesicles. The space between neurons is what we call the synaptic cleft. And so information travels as an electrical signal in the top neuron, converted into a chemical signal. That chemical signal then diffuses over to the bottom cell, and that causes another electrical signal to develop in the bottom cell. So you got electrical, chemical, electrical across this junction between these two neurons. So this junction right here is what we call a synapse. And so the top cell is what we call the presynaptic cell. The bottom one is what we call the postsynaptic cell. And we're going to look at a lot more detail. But this astrocyte is part of the job has to do with this synapse. Because when neurotransmitter is released by the presynaptic neuron, it is the job of the astrocyte sometimes to absorb some of that neurotransmitter, get it out of the synaptic cleft, and recycle it back to the presynaptic neuron. Right, so that's what we call uptake of neurotransmitter. Because you don't want that neurotransmitter to stay in the synaptic cleft forever, because then it can't transmit information anymore. Right? Okay, that would be like having a light switch in your room that you can only turn on one time, and then the lights are on forever. Right? That would not be very helpful. So you'd like to be able to turn the light off by resorbing neurotransmitter into this astrocyte. That helps turn the light off so that it can be turned back on again at a proper time. Okay. Blood-brain barrier. All right, so we saw that astrocyte. We saw that astrocyte, and it has these processes that go over to a capillary. And what can you tell me about your brain? How should it function? Should the function go up? Should it go down? Should it ever go into sleep mode, like completely turn off? I mean, consciousness you can turn off, right? You can sleep, but what happens to your heart? What happens to your breathing? What happens to your blood pressure? It still goes, right? And it's your brain that is controlling all of those things, right? You don't die when you fall asleep. Your body is still very much alive. And so the brain is very susceptible to changes in electrolyte levels and glucose and toxins, right? And so the brain is protected from things that are in the blood. And there is a combination of these astrocytes that will surround a capillary that prevents many things from entering the brain, right, and intoxifying the brain. That's what we call the blood-brain barrier. So astrocytes also make up the blood-brain barrier, and you can see them surrounding this capillary. If this is a blood-brain barrier, then these projections from the astrocyte would be continuous. You wouldn't see these big spaces between them, right, but it would completely surround that capillary. Okay. All right. So that's maybe a review. Oh, there's something I didn't talk about. Let's go back to this slide right here. Right here. The fourth kind of cell, right? We talked about oligodendrocytes. We talked about astrocytes. We got two more cells to talk about. This one right here, microglia cell. It's very much like a Langerhans cell or a dendritic cell in your epidermis. Anybody remember what a dendritic cell does in the epidermis? It kind of crawls around, looks for things that don't belong in the epidermis, like bacteria, fungi, and things like that. So Langerhans cells are part of the immune response of your skin. Microglia is a part of the immune response in your central nervous system. All right, so that's its job, looking for things that don't belong in the brain. Bacteria, fungus, tumor cells, for instance. Right, microglia. If you're fortunate enough, can recognize a tumor cell and destroy it, can lyse that cell. All right, so immune response for microglia. The fourth cell is ependymal cell. And remember, there are big cavities deep inside the brain. What do you call these big cavities deep inside the brain? Fissures? That's a longitudinal separation. But I mean, if you go inside the brain, right, the fissure really is outside the brain. But if you go inside the brain, okay, there are big cavities. The big cavities are called ventricles, right? And so, you know, lateral ventricles, third ventricle, right, fourth, all that, aqueduct, the sylvius. And what's inside those ventricles? Cerebrospinal fluid, right? Cerebros meaning cerebrum, spinal meaning spine, and there's a fluid in there, cerebrospinal, it's not cerebral. And that cerebrospinal fluid comes from a structure we call choroid plexus. Does that ring a bell? I think. Choroid plexus is a combination of a capillary, right, because that plasma is going to leak out, and then it's processed by ependymal cells. So choroid plexus is capillaries, ependymal cells coming together to make cerebrospinal fluid. Right, but all cavities, every part of a cavity inside the brain or every kind of ventricle is lined, right, with these ependymal cells. It almost looks like what? An epithelium, but they're really nerve cells, specialized nerve cells. And again, that helps protect material that is in the cerebrospinal fluid from having direct access to these neurons, which are keeping you alive. Right, so the ependymal cells have a couple jobs. In certain locations, it helps make choroid plexus, but in all locations, it helps protect these neurons from stuff that might be in cerebrospinal fluid. All right. Any questions regarding these support cells? I probably will talk a little bit more about some of those functions in a little bit. Okay, axon regeneration, neurotrophin, blood-brain barrier. Okay, electrical properties, membrane potential, and we're talking about nervous system. And when we talk about electrical properties, which kind of cell do we want to focus on, a neuroglia cell or a neuron? A neuron, right? That's their specialization, is, all right, electrical information. All right. At rest, all cells have a negative internal charge, right? You all agree with that, right? Because of unequal distribution of ions. And what does that result from? A whole bunch of different things, right? Negative proteins that are inside the cell, right? Oh, this is cations. Oh, look at that. Large cations being trapped inside the cell. Ooh, what should you do right here? Change that into an anion, large anions that are trapped inside the cell. All right, and then remember the sodium-potassium pump is electrogenic, and because it doesn't pump equal numbers of sodium-potassium across the cell membrane. And also the cell membrane is very permeable to potassium. There are channels, there are leak channels, so potassium can leak outside of the cell. And they're actually pulled inside the cell because of these anions that are trapped inside the cell. So potassium is attracted, right, by the electrical difference across the cell membrane. And that produces the resting membrane potential. Neurons have this attribute that we call excitability. Excitable cells can discharge this resting membrane potential quickly. All right, so what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other, right? And when a positive and a negative attract each other, what are you left with? Yeah, cancellation or neutral. That's a very low energy state. That's a preferred state, okay? And so across the membrane, you have a separation of charge. Negative on the inside, positive on the outside. That's inherently unstable because what do you know about opposite charges? They like to attract each other, right, to neutralize each other. Well, the cell membrane is preventing that. So there is a discharge of that electrical potential, and we're going to look and see what that produces. It can happen very quickly. And so if you want to neutralize those charges, then you have to change the permeability of these ions across the membrane. So the membrane permeability has to change. But that's okay because you know that cell membranes undergo osmosis. What's one of the conditions for osmosis? Selectively permeable, right? So it allows some things through, not other things, and then just an extension of that concept is it will allow some things through at certain times and then not at other times. That's selectively permeable. All right, neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct electrical impulses. Changes in membrane permeability is what we're talking about, right? So neurons and muscles can change permeability to ions across the cell membrane. Right, and as a result, both muscles and neurons can generate electrical impulses. So if I were to ask you, what can conduct an electrical impulse? You would say, for sure, a neuron, but there's another kind of cell, and that is a muscle cell as well. So muscle cells and neurons are similar in that respect. They have similar kinds of special proteins or channels in the cell membrane. But what's the big difference between a neuron and a muscle cell? Big difference. One is just a muscle cell. Ah, ooh, all your muscle cells are getting really pissed off at you for saying that. Muscle cells can do what when that impulse goes over them? They can't, and the neuron can't, so a neuron is now getting very jealous. That's right, a muscle contracts, right? Neurons cannot contract. I mean, they can maybe undergo that peristalsis for axoplasmic flow, but that's about it. All right, so we got to get a little bit more sophisticated with understanding this electrical activity across the cell membrane. So here we have a cell. What kind of cell does this look like to you? And it's kind of the namesake of this chapter. This is a neuron, right? So here is a neuron. And we said that there's a separation of charge across the membrane, negative on the inside, positive on the outside. We're going to say the positive is like the zero. It's going to be the ground, it's going to be the reference point to where we're going to measure voltage, right? A voltage, you have to measure the electrical potential at two different locations to see if there's a difference in potential. We're going to say outside the cell is always going to be zero, right? And when the cell is at rest, if it's zero on the outside, what's the inside going to be? It's going to be negative, right? It's going to be negative. So here is a special little voltmeter. You can't put both of these terminals inside the cell because there's not going to be a voltage difference between these two little, what we call, electrodes. Right? So, but if we put one inside and one outside and use the one outside as the reference to measure, then the inside is going to be negative. We'll stick these electrodes, this one little electrode inside the nerve cell, and we'll display what that voltage is. We'll show it on a TV screen, right? But this is a special TV screen set up to just look at voltages. This is what we call an oscilloscope. That's not on this slide. You'll be using some simulations of an oscilloscope in lab, right? So here is zero. That's the reference point where this electrode is. Right, and then if the voltage is down over here below zero, we're going to call that negative voltage. And if it's up above zero, we're going to call that a positive voltage. And a millivolt is, what, a thousandth of a volt? It's not that small of a volt. All right, so the resting cell. Anybody remember from previous chapter what the resting membrane potential is? Minus 70. And does this slide agree with you? Indeed it does, right? So we stick these electrodes inside the cell, and then I see a little trace on the oscilloscope right at minus 70, and that is nice. So this is a nice normal cell. Do you think it's difficult to get an electrode inside the cell like this? Okay, it might seem pretty difficult, but you know what? It's not really too difficult. Have you ever had a glass tube and put it in a Bunsen burner? What happens to that glass? Yeah, it melts, right? It gets really soft. You can bend it, you know, if you're a glass blower, you can stretch it. So if you heat up that glass tube and so that it starts to melt and then pull it apart really fast, okay, that tube gets what? Smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. When it gets really, really small, it finally breaks. So the ends of that glass tube are microscopic. And then you fill that tube with a little salt solution and jab it inside the cell right here with a microscope, and it's really easy to put an electrode inside the cell. But you have to watch where you point that little glass tube because you can't see the end with your naked eye. Right? But it's still something that you could jab into your body or your eye or something like that. So it's pretty easy to measure these voltages. Okay, we got three terms that I want for you to know something about. Okay, besides resting membrane potential that we see on minus 70 millivolts, if the voltage across the membrane changes so that it goes toward zero, right? So if it goes from here, from minus 70 to minus 60, what happens to that voltage? Is it staying the same? Is it getting more, getting less? Okay. From minus 60 to minus 50 or minus 70 to minus 60, it is, there's less voltage because it's going to zero. It's just becoming less negative. And from minus 60 to minus 40, less voltage, right? And when it gets to zero, then it's completely neutral across the cell. All right, so when resting membrane potential moves from minus 70 in a direction towards zero, the voltage is going away, right? Because zero is what? Zero is zero, right? We call that depolarization. When resting membrane potential moves towards zero, we call that depolarization. And you just have to memorize for right now that that is an excitatory event. That is stimulation. Depolarization is excitatory, even though you see this is going to a more relaxed state, right, if they're completely canceled out. But that is excitatory. If resting membrane potential moves farther away from zero, right, that means the voltage across the membrane is getting bigger, it's getting larger, even though it's a negative number. We call that hyperpolarization. When cells hyperpolarize, you will want to remember that as inhibition. Right, depolarization is excitation. Hyperpolarization is inhibition. Well, fortunately, right, after a cell depolarizes, whether it goes to zero or even overshoots above zero, right, if it's a nice living cell, that membrane potential is going to go back to resting membrane potential, right, when the cell is at rest. When it goes from an excited state back to rest, that's what we call repolarization. Right, repolarization. Repolarization is neither excitatory or inhibitory. It's just making the cell go back to RMP. That's the whole job of repolarization. All right, so that's really the take-home message here. RMP, depolarization, and you should know something about, you're going to learn a lot about depolarization, but right now you know it's an excitatory event. What's an inhibitory event? Hyperpolarization. What's happening across the cell membrane when it becomes inhibited? What happens to the voltage? Inside the cell becomes, somebody told me, inside the cell becomes more negative compared to the outside. More negative, right? Inside the cell is becoming more negative. Look at it right here. It's going what? Minus 70, minus 75, minus 80, minus 90. Sold. Okay? Okay, that's what we call hyperpolarization because it's getting farther away from zero. Okay. Now, ions cannot move across the cell membrane because why? Why is that? Two different ways you can talk about it. Because they're charged. Yeah, if you talk about it in terms of the ions or electrolytes, they are polar, right? They like to be in a water environment, and the cell membrane is nonpolar, right? All the fatty acids. So ions cannot move across the membrane by themselves. But if there are special proteins in the membrane that form a little channel or tunnel, then these ions can move across based on their concentration and their electrical charge. All right, so the membrane potential changes occur by the flow of ions through membrane channels. Can't get through a membrane itself, but through these proteins that we call membrane channels. Some channels are always open. Like we said, the leakage channels for potassium. So potassium can enter the cell because of all those big negative charges inside the cell. Right? Some are closed. Right? And actually, some can be open sometimes and closed at other times. That is what we call a gated channel. Channels that are open all the time are not gated, but channels that can open and close are what we call gated, depending on what that cell is experiencing. Right? And so some channels that are gated change the gate changes state depending on what the voltage is across the membrane. All right, so how would you look at that? You'd look at this oscilloscope. We see that the voltage can change. This voltage-gated channel sometimes is open or closed depending on where this trace is on the oscilloscope. That's what we call voltage-gated. All right, voltage-gated channels are closed in resting cells. The sodium channel, right now this is just sort of memorization for you, sodium channels are voltage-gated. Right, they're closed in resting cells, but, let's go back, here is a cell at rest. When it depolarizes, okay, sodium, we said, is a voltage-gated channel. When the cell depolarizes, sodium channels open up. All right, and where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside. What's the charge of a sodium? Positive. Okay, what's the charge on the inside of the membrane?
Negative.
Negative. So when a sodium channel opens up, what does sodium just love to do? It loves to rush inside the cell to neutralize those charges, but also to equalize the concentration across the membrane. Okay? And since when sodium enters the cell, that causes, I'll tell you what, when sodium enters the cell, what does that cause?
Depolarization.
That's right. So it changes the membrane potential even more. All right. So these sodium gated channels are closed in resting cells. Yeah. Yeah, depolarization. I see it. Depolarization starts from RMP. What's the voltage at RMP inside the cell?
Minus
70.
So it doesn't have to stop at zero.
Doesn't have to stop at zero. But if it goes from minus 70 to minus 60, minus 50, to the minus 20, that is depolarization. And it can even go the other way. It can go from zero to plus 40, plus 50. Okay, we still are going to call that depolarization in this class. Okay. Hyperpolarization will be a deviation from RMP to more negative. Deviation of RMP to more positive is depolarization, even if it goes above zero. Okay. Yeah, so that's a really good question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but that Nernst equation can only describe a little part of why the resting membrane potential is there. Right? In order to understand that resting membrane potential, what are some effects that you have to add together? Sodium-potassium pump? All those anions that are trapped inside the cell? Concentration differences of all these other ions? Right? So that sodium equilibrium potential is just for the sodium ion ignoring everything else. But everything else you see has a major effect on RMP. Okay? Okay. Well, how is this possible? We're talking about proteins in a membrane. Do you see a membrane on this slide? You do. Wow, this is like being in court. I'm a lawyer. Okay. I see a membrane because I see a phospholipid bilayer, which is going to exclude the transfer of electrolytes from one side to the other. Here's a protein. So if you're going to describe this membrane to somebody, would you use the phospholipid bilayer model to describe it? I see phospholipid bilayer. But what about all this junk here? Okay, yeah, that's an integral protein. So if you have phospholipid bilayer with integral proteins, you should use the fluid mosaic model to understand the membrane. All right, so here we have a nice fluid mosaic model. And here's a channel. And I see in the first state, what about this channel? What can you tell me about this channel? It is closed. All right, so if this is a sodium channel, this is what a sodium channel looks like at rest, at RMP. It is closed. Sodium cannot move across the membrane. Right, but if this membrane depolarizes, meaning the voltage inside the cell goes from minus 70 to something less negative, yeah, right, then it's going to pull on this protein. It's going to change the conformation of this protein because there are charges on these proteins in different locations, right? And now the protein changes conformation, so now we have this channel open. And sodium can go across. Which way is it going to go? It's going to go in. For what reason? Chemical reason or electrical reason? Electrical reason. I heard electrical. I heard chemical. And you know what? It's both. Yeah, the electrochemical gradient is just going to suck sodium inside the cell rapidly. And then as that positive charge enters the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It depolarizes even more, right? Depolarizing means it becomes more positive, right? Okay, but here is something. All right, so the channel is now open. We know that the sodium channel can be inactivated. After it is activated, it can become inactivated, and this is a way that we can think of inactivation. There's another side chain of a protein that's inside the cell, and right now this channel is completely open. But at a certain electrical point, this ball can move up into the channel. Even though the channel is open, it's going to plug up the channel, right? And we're going to call that an inactivation gate. So a channel can be open, but if the inactivation gate is activated, then the channel for all purposes is closed. And this is really a way that we would like to think of sodium channels, right? It can be closed, can be open, but even if it's open, the function of it can stop if the inactivation gate is deployed. We're going to see why that's important pretty soon. Action potential. All right, this is going to be another extra credit drawing for you in lab if somebody sends me an email over the weekend to remind me to send it out to you guys. Okay, action potential. All right, so you know membrane potential, resting membrane potential. What's happening to the voltage at RMP? Is it changing? No, it's just constant, right? It's just flat. Action potential means what? Yeah, there's something changing with the membrane potential. It's just not flat at minus 70. It is changing. And it is changing because of voltage-gated channels, right? And it is changing that action potential. You could even call this an action voltage if you wanted to. And I see it over here. So I'm looking at the face of an oscilloscope. So the vertical axis, we always want to look at the axes first. The vertical axis is a measure of the voltage across the membrane. At RMP, what should it be? Is that minus 70 on this diagram? Indeed it is. Okay, this is versus time. So voltage versus time, not location, but versus time. And can you see that the voltage across the membrane is changing versus time? Minus 70, minus 70, and then what happens? Forget about this line down over here. It starts to go up, okay, towards zero. What do we call going up towards zero? Depolarization. That's depolarization. And what kind of event is that, excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory, right. So this is what we're going to call a stimulus. We'll see how this stimulus comes about sooner or later. When the membrane voltage reaches, in this particular case, looks like about minus 55. So it's going from minus 70 to minus 55. There's something special that happens at minus 55. Those sodium channels open up. So this stimulus was not produced by those voltage-gated sodium channels, they don't open up until this point right here. We call that the threshold voltage, right? So if membrane potential reaches threshold, then a whole bunch of sodium channels open up. Sodium does what? Rushes inside the cell, neutralizing those negative charges. So what happens to membrane potential? Depolarizes more, right? And then depolarization stops at this peak. What happens right here, right? Sodium still would want to enter the cell, but at this point it can no longer enter the cell because that inactivation gate is deployed, closes the sodium channel. So what happens to a change in membrane potential if the inactivation gate is working? It can't depolarize anymore. All right, so then there is this descending limb, and I see the voltage going to zero, and then to threshold, and then to resting membrane potential. What do we call this descending limb of this object that we're looking at? That is repolarization. Yep, repolarization. And notice what happens after repolarization. It actually goes below resting membrane potential. It overshoots a little bit. What do we call this overshoot from? That is hyperpolarization. That's right. But eventually, resting membrane potential is restored after a certain period of time. Now, this is in milliseconds. That's pretty accurate. All right. Yeah, question.
You're saying when it reaches the peak, that's when the sodium blocks the channel?
Yep, that's when that inactivation gate blocks the sodium channel. Okay, it blocks the sodium channel. That inactivation gate is deployed. Okay, and it stays deployed until... Right, the cell goes back to resting membrane potential. So it's closed this whole period of time.
So the action potential, they work at the negative feedback.
Let's look at feedback. Yeah, let's look at feedback in a little bit, in just a couple seconds, mere seconds. So this object that we see right here with a stimulus, depolarization phase, repolarization, hyperpolarization, going back to RMP, this is what we call an action potential. Action potential is due to two ions, right? And what is depolarization a result of? Sodium rushing inside the cell, right? Now, what about here? After depolarization takes the cell to where it's now positive inside the cell, what ion is typically high inside the cell at rest?
Potassium.
Does potassium have a charge?
Yep.
It does. What's the charge? It's positive. All right, so it's positive, and in this region right here on the action potential, okay, you have a positive charge, namely potassium, in an environment that is positive compared to the outside, which you could think of now as negative. You have a high concentration of potassium inside the cell, low outside the cell. So if a potassium channel opens up, will potassium want to go someplace? Potassium? Okay, where is potassium at a high, at rest, inside the cell, right? So when you reach this point right here, potassium will want to leave the cell because it's at high concentration inside. And what about the charge inside the cell?
But what is
the voltage inside the cell right here? It's positive, yeah. So that depolarization caused the voltage to go positive. So now there's absolutely no reason why potassium wants to stay inside the cell. Wants to leave because the outside now is negative and there's very low concentration of potassium. And when potassium leaves the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? Well, because potassium has a positive charge, when that positive charge leaves the cell, then that causes repolarization, right? That membrane potential goes back to zero, then more negative, back to RMP, and then there's even a little bit of an overshoot, a little bit of hyperpolarization. All right, so at that level, I think it's pretty easy to understand an action potential based on these electrolytes, right? Based on the concentration difference across the membrane and the electrical potential or the electrical difference across the membrane as well.
So when that side chain 13 plugs the channel?
Right here.
Yeah.
Prevents any further depolarization. They're working all the time,
okay.
But this event right here is just passive.
Okay.
This happens so fast that it overshadows anything the sodium-potassium pump can do. But after here, when the cell gets back to RMP, and then you wait a couple seconds or a minute, then that's when the sodium potassium pumps readjust all these ions back to where they should be at rest. Okay? And the sodium potassium pump helps set up the cell to become excitable, which means what? It can generate an action potential. That's the whole job of those sodium potassium pumps. But it's that ATP from a sodium potassium pump is not being used directly to make this action potential happen as it's happening. All right, this is just a purely passive kind of marvelous thing that happens. All right, so this would be, I'm going to send this figure to you. I've maybe modified it a little bit. I'll have to see. All right, let's go to the information that we see on the left-hand side. The stuff maybe we should look at the first, but I like talking about the action potential first. So what do we call this deviation from RMP more positive to threshold? That's depolarization, but it's a special kind of depolarization. We're going to call it a stimulus, right? Right? And indeed, we said that a depolarization is excitatory or stimulatory. So here's a stimulus. So that's where we're going to start on this diagram. Depolarization stimulus means that the resting membrane potential is going to deviate up toward the threshold. So this depolarization stimulus will open voltage gated channels. It says voltage regulated, right? Or sodium voltage gated channels. And so what happens when a sodium channel opens up? Sodium rushes into the cell. Okay? As it rushes into the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It depolarizes even more, right? So that causes more depolarization, and guess what happens? More voltage-gated channels open up because the cell is depolarizing. So more sodium enters the cell, and that causes more sodium voltage-gated channels to open up, right? Which causes more sodium to enter the cells. So this is not a negative feedback mechanism. This is a positive feedback mechanism. So you could use this as another example of where a positive feedback mechanism is normal and healthy inside the body, and you would say what? An action potential. That's why this depolarization after stimulus is so rapid, because you have this positive feedback mechanism taking place. Okay. Well, one thing I haven't mentioned yet, and that is these potassium channels. Some are open all the time, but there are also voltage-gated potassium channels, right? And what we're looking at here are voltage-gated potassium channels. Right, so with this depolarization stimulus, there are some voltage-gated potassium channels that start to open up. Right, some potassium leaks out of the cell that causes less depolarization. Okay, and that effect is not seen until the sodium-gated channel is closed, which is at this point right here because of that inactivation gate. So right here, the voltage-sodium gated channels are closed. But what channel is open here? The potassium channels are still open. So they're slower. They're slower to open up, and they remain open for a longer period of time because they do not have an inactivation gate. Okay, but remember this little positive feedback mechanism. What does it say on the slide? Action potential is a wave of membrane potential change that sweeps along an axon from hillock to synapse. Well, that is a nerve impulse. A nerve impulse is one of these guys, right? This guy here is an action potential. As this action potential moves along an axon, we call that a nerve impulse. Action potential in motion is a nerve impulse. All right, and that action potential is a rapid depolarization followed by a rapid repolarization. If I ask you what ion is important for repolarization, you would say? Yeah, potassium. What's important for depolarization? You would say sodium, right? Okay, so here we have an axon, and what happens if we come up with a compound that can block these voltage-gated sodium channels? Let's take some neurons that are transmitting pain and put a chemical on it that will block sodium voltage-gated sodium channels. What's going to happen? All right, so we're going to put a chemical on this axon, right? And if we block sodium-gated channels, what about this rapid depolarization phase? It won't happen, right? And so this membrane potential, right, is going to be way down over here. The stimulus is not going to be noticed by the neuron. So what's going to happen to a person's perception then of this stimulus? Nothing. it's going to be ignored because this action potential was never initiated to travel down the axon. So that's one common way that an anesthetic is used, right, to block sodium channels to prevent action potentials from moving down a neuron, especially if it's a pain pathway. Okay, lidocaine, probably novocaine, right, block these sodium channels, right? If these sodium, what did we say the sodium channel does? It produces a depolarization, right? If we block that depolarization, we're blocking the excitatory event on that cell. Okay? Okay. Let's see what's on the next slide. Can we? Okay. I think I talked about everything on this slide already. Talked about everything on that slide. Talked about this. Okay. ATP pump is not necessary for an action potential because it's passive, but ATP pump is necessary to maintain resting membrane potential, right? It restores resting membrane potential after the action potential takes place. And I think next time I'm going to start talking, okay, in lecture with these two slides right here. All right, but and I think the sign-in sheet is going around. Did I pass it around? I did. It's going around someplace. So please sign that sheet. Okay, so spend some time with these electrical properties of a neuron so that we can figure out the rest of this chapter.